This is Deanna Spingola. It is Wednesday, June 6, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Anthony Lawson, and I'm certain that most of our listeners have heard his magnificent voice on the many, many videos that he has produced. If you have not subscribed to his YouTube channel, I recommend that you do so. Good morning, or I guess it's good evening where you're at, Anthony.
It certainly is. I live in Thailand, south of Thailand. And it has not stopped raining, I don't think, for about 3 days now. And I'm getting a bit tired of it. But it's evening, but I wouldn't say it's a good evening. There we are.
Okay. Well, why do you live in Thailand?
It was a sort of an economic decision. When I used to live with my family in Hong Kong, I lived for a long time in the UK, and then when I ceased to become sort of directorial flavor of the month there, moved to Hong Kong and took up the job of a creative director with an advertising agency called Leo Burnett. But I didn't like being in the agency business, so I left that, and I had my own production company called The Box Office, and that went quite well. But in 1997, when China took over, the British lease expired on Hong Kong, work for people, Gualos as we're called in Hong Kong, foreigners, foreign devils, sort of took a dive. And I was in the middle of another project, and we needed to live somewhere which is a lot cheaper than Hong Kong, because Hong Kong is very, very expensive place to live. And so we moved to Thailand, first to Chiang Mai, and then we moved south because of the education, better education prospects for our son. And here I am, still there. He's now left home, and he's working, and I'm left here. I couldn't really go back to Hong Kong. There's not enough of the sort of work I do there, so I sit around making videos about all the bad things that are going on in the world.
Well, there's certainly enough material to make a lot of videos, isn't there?
You got that right. Absolutely.
You could do one almost every day if you could.
Well, just recently I've slowed down a little, because it takes a tremendous amount out of one. The way I make them, they a lot of people make suggestions. Why don't you do one on this? Why don't you do one on that? It doesn't happen that way. Something just happens inside my head, and I think I really have to do something about that. And then it's a tremendous struggle sort of getting it into shape and redoing it. And every now and then I just start one and never finish it, because it just doesn't seem right. It doesn't get there. So and recently I've decided I want to have a bit of a break. So I'm writing a book which has nothing to do with politics, nothing to do with saving the world or anything like that. I just want to, I've had this idea for a long time, and I think it'll make a very good film. But it's very hard to get an agent to sort of flog ideas like that, which are just very, esoteric and sort of a bit way out. So I decided to write a book about it. Whether I'm going to succeed, I don't know.
Well, I think you've been pretty successful at all the other things that you've engaged in. So I would surmise that this would be successful also.
Well, that's good. If you know any publishers, let me know.
All righty. I actually I've written three books, two of which have nothing whatsoever to do with politics, but I did have a publisher. In fact, two publishers approached me to write a book for them within a couple of days of each other. And then I spent a couple of years working on it, and just 3 weeks before it was to, you know, supposed to be coming out, the publisher wanted me to make all kinds of changes, and I thought, gosh, I spent all this time, and certainly I, you know, I'm open to making changes, but the changes that he required would have just kind of taken the meat out of the entire book, so I decided to publish it myself, it gives you a lot more control over your own work.
You bet, you bet. What was the subject? Is it was it a teaching book or?
No. The name of the book is The Ruling Elite: A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation.
Oh, that sounds political. I thought you said it wasn't political.
Well,
that was me, was it? I don't know.
Well, the first two books that I wrote weren't political. They were on quilt patterns. I designed some quilt patterns. That requires.
Right. Okay.
You know, art quilts, not the kind of things that you put on your bed, but they're very artistic and needed a lot of mathematical skills and whatnot. And they were quite successful, I believe. And but anyway, then I left that field and got back to what I was really interested in. But all of your videos are remarkable, but the most recent one is called International Bureau of Double Standards, the CNN/Iran file, and that came out May 30th, 2012. And that is you do such a great job on all of your videos, but tell us about that video and why you decided to do it and what it's about.
Well, when I saw the CNN program it's based on, I've actually forgotten the title, I could look it up, but it's not really important. It was basically a hit piece on yet another one on Iran's alleged nuclear ambitions. And it was so biased that I thought I must do something. I had actually made the decision not to do any more videos at that point. I saw this. I did a transfer of it onto from my TV recorder, and I had it sort of waiting. I thought, no, I must get on with what I really want to do, and that's write this book. And then it was rebroadcast, and I lay in bed one night thinking, if I do it quickly, I can get it done quickly, because it has to be done. And it's Christian Amanpour rabbiting on and interviewing people all over the place about the Iran situation, the Israel-Iran situation, with Israel demanding that something is done about Iran's nuclear program. They call what would they say that their possibility of building an atomic bomb, which the Iranians say that they're not going to do. It's against their religion. It's against, there is a fatwa about it, and they just keep on going on and on and on. I thought, this is ridiculous, because we all know that Israel has, well, up to 400, I suppose, nuclear weapons. We've got the Germans now admitting that they're putting together submarines for them to be able to launch these weapons, and nothing, no questions are ever asked of Israel. You know, when will you use the bomb? You know that you've got. It's always Iran. Why won't you stop building a bomb? Which they won't. And I mean, it's absurd. The whole situation is so biased and ridiculous. Excuse me. That it needed something said about it, which I've now done. It probably won't do much good. But, you know, there comes a time when you have that feeling about something, you've just got to do something about it, because I've got children and I've got grandchildren, and I don't want, you know, to pass the end of my life thinking I could have done more. Well, of course I could do more, but I would hate to, you know, to be at that point and think I didn't do anything. Which is terrible. Yeah.
Well, that is a remarkable way of looking at things, and I certainly understand how you feel about that. And you've done just a remarkable job. And as you say, the corporate-owned media is just constantly talking about Iran and that they might build a bomb, where in fact that, you know, they're targeting Iran. Well, the corporate media is targeting Iran for a very particular reason. And and people buy into this.
Yeah, well, one of the other points I make in the video is that hardly a week has gone by over the last few months when there hasn't been some meeting of the heads of state and their financial advisors all, you know, moaning about the situation, what's wrong with the economics of the world, and not one interview, guru, financial so-called expert, politician, mentions the fact that the country that has 10% of the world's oil and is its fourth, or I think it's the fourth largest exporter of oil, is being sanctioned up to the hilt. And nobody makes any mention that could be having any effect on the world's economic situation, which is utterly absurd. Of course, it must be having an effect, because every time there's a bit of a scare, the oil futures market goes mad and the price of oil goes up, or the futures go up and what have you, because people are so nervous, because energy is what drives the world. You cannot get away from that. And if you're attacking the country that has about 10% of the oil's known resources and is the fourth largest exporter, of course the price of energy is going to go up, and of course that's going to affect everybody. But there's nothing ever mentioned about it. There was a huge interview today, a very long interview I saw today, another one, you know, on the BBC about the Queen's, 60th anniversary and all that sort of thing. And this guru, there he was again, talking about the economic status, the situation in the world, and what's going on in Europe and Spain and Portugal and wherever you like to think of. But not one mention of the sanctions against Iran. It is absurd.
And of course, sanctions have always been used by the Allies, or the the Brits and the Americans, and it works to intimidate the country that they've targeted, and of course it has killed, at least in Iraq, 500,000 children during those years of sanctions.
Yeah, well, I'd have to disagree with you. It killed the children,
right?
But it didn't stop Saddam Hussein, did it? They still had to go to war in the end. Well, they thought they had to go to war in the end. Saddam Hussein didn't stop doing anything because of the sanctions. He just kept on. The country did not bring him down through any sort of uprising, because the people who are affected by such sanctions are never the heads of state who are doing the so-called bad things, who are the bad people. It's always the people who suffer, which is what is going on in Iran at the moment. I actually have a couple of Iranian friends, and they say it's not too bad. It's just very irritating, you know. It's just the fact that, you know, they are not doing anything, but they're being punished for it and not allowed to. And Israel wants to make the sanctions bite. They want to do basically the same thing that happened in Iraq, and they want to restrict medicines and things like this, and we'll have the same sort of situation. Well, I don't think the Iranians are not going to give in. It's crazy. They will not do so. I think they've met their match here, and one almost has the feeling, I wish they'd go a little bit further, because they're going to have a huge lesson taught to them, because they cannot keep on treating people, their neighbors, the Palestinians, the way they're doing it. It just cannot go on. And the world has got to recognize that. And I hope it isn't going to be through another war. But if it is, the Iranians will teach them something.
Well, the Iranians do have a military that the Iraqis did not have. I mean, they had, they were pretty much spent during, their previous warfare. And but what I meant by it worked, I mean, I think that's the purpose of sanctions is to hurt the population as a way of trying to, as that population tries to influence the leaders to do something. But that isn't what happened, certainly in Iraq. It just
Can you remember any situation where sanctions have changed a regime? I can't.
No, but it just kills a lot of innocent people that have
exactly.
nothing to do with any of the decision making.
So they work in sanctions work in the sense that they affect a lot of people, but they don't do what they're supposed to do,
no.
and that's change regimes. And I think it's a disgusting thing to do anyway. It's immoral to threaten people who are not doing anything. Saddam Hussein was a different kettle of fish, but I mean the Americans and the British were in they were in his pocket, or and he was in their pocket for a long, long time because of Iran. I mean the bottom line about Iran is that the Americans and the British have never forgiven Iran for overthrowing the Shah, who was their puppet, who they put in place. Back in 1953, when Mohammad Mossadegh had just been elected prime minister, and he changed, nationalized the oil companies because they were taking 78% of the revenues, and Iran, poor old Iran, was getting 12%. So he nationalized it, quite right. It was just like Nasser when he nationalized the Suez Canal. And, of course, everybody got uptight about that. But they were ripping them off. I mean, what anybody's language, it was a rip-off. 12% of the oil revenues going to the country that owned the oil, and the rest going to Britain in that case. So the CIA and the MI6... got together, got some people together and overthrew Mossadegh, put the Shah back in, and they had 60, I can't remember the exact number, but up until 79, they had, the American puppet ruling them. And then they got awfully upset when there was a revolution and they put the American embassy staff basically, they kept them in jail for how long was that?
Oh, a long time. I mean, it was...
Long time. But you see,
Reagan and Carter.
Carter. Carter tried to invade to, sort the hostage crisis out. They didn't kill anybody. They just kept them prisoner because... they'd been basically kept prisoner themselves in their own country for such a long time, and they wanted the world to know about it. But the British and Americans have never forgiven Iran for doing that. And they keep on going about not having a proper democracy, and Israel's the only democracy, excuse me, in the Middle East. Iran's democracy is a different kind of democracy. I'm not in any way... an Islamist or any kind of religionist at all. I think it'd be a good thing if all religions were ditched. But, that's the way they run their country, and they should be allowed to. But they weren't. And when they actually overthrew the Shah, tossed him out, the Brits and the Americans have never forgiven them, and they never will. This is the problem. It's a bad memory. They were, I can't remember the word for it. This is when I write my script. I have a lot of time to think of the exact words I'm looking for. It is just one of those things. There's a great line in The Magnificent Ambersons, Orson Welles, about the Ambersons getting their comeuppance not once, not twice, but three times over. And the Americans and the Brits will get that one day, because they cannot keep on doing what they've been doing. It's astonishing that they've got away with it for so long. My mother was English, and I mean, I don't consider the general population. I don't, when I say the Brits and the Americans, the general population, it's the administrations. It's the very, very greedy people who, you know, sufficient is never enough for them. They always want more, and they always want to take it from somebody else.
Right. And, well, they're... You know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think I'd finished. I can't remember what I was going to say.
You know, it's always about resources of another country and plundering. And as you say, the British went into Iran when, you know, 1908, 1909, and basically took all, you know, made a deal and have been taking the oil out of that country all those decades. And Mossadegh had an absolute perfectly good reason to nationalize it. He was fairly elected. And they just could not stand it, and they certainly didn't wait very long to go in there with their secrets, you know, the CIA and the other intelligence agency from Britain to take him out.
They're
terrible
bullies.
Thing.
They're bullies. That's what they are. I was bullied at school, and I think, you know, some of that is maybe one of the reasons why I do what I do about these kinds of things, because I cannot stand bullies. One of the worst situations wasn't against me, because I eventually grew up and I was able to thump them. I got a bit taller than they did over one Christmas holiday, and it was wonderful. But I'll never forget, there's one little boy a teacher found in the washrooms with his face streaming with blood. He'd been trying to sandpaper his freckles off because he was being tormented by other children about his freckles, and it just destroyed the poor little boy's life. I think he was about 9 or something at the time. I didn't realize, I was getting my own bit of bullying, and I didn't realize what was happening to him. But it, you know, it turned the school upside down in the end. I mean, it was shocking, and the way that it was allowed to go on, and nobody in authority noticed it. And this is what's happening in the world. America is the biggest bully around. And they've got their planted bully now in the Middle East to do that for them. Lebanon and anybody that, you know, doesn't do what they want them to do. If they're not stopped, they'll just keep on doing it.
Right. Now, who's driving the engine here? Is it Israel driving America, or is it America driving Israel to be a bully?
I think it's almost impossible to know which is which. It's obviously, I think it's, if you trace it back to the rise of Zionism toward the end of the 19th century, when Theodore Herzl said, we are going to establish Israel in the Middle East, you know, surrounding Jerusalem. That was 1897 in Baal. And he predicted that it wouldn't happen next year, or not in 10 years, maybe 50. And he was right, except for 1 year. It took 51 years from that date. It's been going on for such a long time. There are all kinds of machinations between the Nazis and the Zionists. In fact, Eustace Mullins thinks that, who's now dead, but I just saw a video of his the other day, which is really remarkable. He said that the actual word Nazi comes from the NA of National Socialists and the ZI of Zionism.
Necessarily believe everything that Eustace Mullins said. I believe that he said a lot of things, but he had his facts and figures wrong when he was talking about the Federal Reserve and who were the owners behind that organization. So I don't know whether
Nazis and the Zionists were certainly hand in glove, because the first person to say to use the term, the final solution for the Jewish people was, in fact, Theodor Herzl. And he said it in 1897. And there's a book called The Transfer Agreement.
By Black. Edwin Black.
Edwin Black. You've seen that book.
Well, if yes.
You look at that, yeah, if you look at that book, you know very well that they were hand in glove. And the idea was that the Jews would move to Palestine. And this was the arrangement when it all got wrong toward the end of the war and there was not much else going on and there was starvation because there wasn't enough money, fuel or anything else. And they dreamt up this idea that there were gas chambers, which I don't think there were.
No, absolutely not.
There were gas chambers for delousing.
Right.
Clothing, bedclothes and stuff like that. If they had bedclothes, I don't know. But there were no human gas chambers. I've done a video on this. I don't know if you've seen it, which is called Holocaust Hate Speech. And were the Germans so stupid?
Exactly. I love that video. It's a very good video.
Well, you know, the reason why it's called Were the Germans So Stupid is that the way that they claim that the commanders of each of the individual prison camps, work camps, many people call them, were supposedly allowed to sort of dream up their own methods of exterminating and carrying out what they said was the extermination policy. But, I mean, the Germans are so efficient. And look what they've done since the beginning, in the middle of the 19th century. Their industrial progress has been phenomenal. And they would not just let that happen. If they were going to kill a whole load of people, they'd have it so well organized that there wouldn't be just, stick them in a van or something like this.
Right.
drop a few pellets of Zyklon B in there. It's just impossible to believe that. But we've been brainwashed about it, and I think I worked it out. It's 250 million people in Europe are under threat of prison or fines for looking into it. Now, in one of my videos, or maybe in my imagination, but no, yes, in one of my videos, I do actually forget which particular image I put in some of them. I have a shot of the Titanic going down. Now, nobody denies that the Titanic sank and that a lot of people died, but they are still, and they've only just discovered, what gave way in the Titanic. And it wasn't to do with the steel, which was, there was a great question about whether the ship had been badly built. And the answer was no, it wasn't badly built. But they've just spent, I think it goes almost as far as $1 billion, and these craft, these deep sea craft and cameras and things like this, certainly $500 million, for the $500 million or something, to determine, what went wrong with the Titanic. But if you try to look to see what really happened during the so-called Holocaust. Now, I do not deny that many, many Jews died and other people died. Up to 60 million died during that war. But the fact that we are not supposed to, on pain of, I can, and you can still, but how long is that going to last, look into these matters. And there are many, many situations that need looking into. But the very fact that so much of a cloak is trying to be, they're trying to draw so much of a cloak over it, means that they are trying to hide something. Now, that's not right. It's a historical period, and it requires investigations because of the old saying is, if we don't, take care of what happened in history, it's likely to happen again.
Of course.
And of course it is. It's happening to the Palestinians.
Right. And the transfer agreement, at least 108 countries had dispatched the Jews, had deported the Jews over, the centuries. And the transfer agreement was simply Germany's way of eliminate, or I shouldn't use that word, of transferring a group of people, not the Jews who had lived in Germany for a very long time, but a lot of the Jews who had come in from the East. It was simply a good way of transferring these people out of Germany. And that is, nothing less than what many other countries had done.
This is very true. There are also some very dark periods in all of this because I'm just looking it up here now. I looked it up today and I wrote it to somebody else. But let's see if I can find it.
Interestingly, I interviewed Germar Rudolph yesterday.
And no, did you?
Yes.
I mean, Germar quite a lot. He's a really good guy. Yeah.
Wonderful person. And I've been reading his book. In fact, I stayed up quite late last night doing more reading in it. And he was talking about, the dogma that everybody believes, the popular myths that everybody believes. And when you look at the science behind it, people are not allowed to present the science. And that is what happened to him. And that is what is happening in Germany.
Absolutely. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, it's terrible because, here's a man who, had a brilliant career with one of the most, the Max Planck Institute, scientific institute. And, the moment he proposed that the way what we'd been told after all these years wasn't quite, any sort of truth, never mind about the whole truth and nothing but the truth. He lost his job. He was, how long did he spend in jail? 4 years, I think.
Just about 45 months. 45 months. So
that's long enough, isn't it?
And they deported him from the United States, which
I
is
know.
Terrible.
I know. Monsters. I can't find this particular. Where am I actually? I don't know. I think I've got the wrong script. But it was a. What it was that there was an offer made by the Germans that the Zionists could have all of the Jews that were left in Eastern Europe for $2 million, right, to do what, to take them away. But the Zionists refused, basically, and there's a letter which is written in Hebrew, which is, it's on the internet somewhere, was saying basically that, they need to be seen to be suffering because at the end of the war there are going to be a lot of people around the table, and if the Jews are not seen to be suffering, then they're not going to have many bargaining chips.
Ah.
It was as cruel as that. And I think this must be one of the major issues that they want to cover up. That the Zionists want to pull a cloak over and say no, they never behave like that. That there could have been many more people saved, but the fact that I don't think, and many people, Germar Rudolph was one, and there are a lot of other people, don't think that there's no evidence for human gas chambers. Certainly there were crematoriums. Or crematoria, I suppose, to be Latin correct, but because a lot of people died, and that's because mostly because of the Allied bombing toward the end of the war. They didn't have supplies, there wasn't fuel or anything. I mean, how they could have wasted money burning people when they needed to the war effort needed. Uniforms and all sorts of things that they made in these camps. It's just appalling. I read somewhere, I think it was today, that the Holocaust business didn't really start until 1977.
Right. Right.
Is that right?
Yes. Actually, they had a miniseries on NBC called Holocaust. And this was presented in four parts, and this was in 1978. And in 1976, 77, you had what was called the Skokie March. The Nazis were supposed to they wanted to march in Skokie, which is an enclave of a lot of Holocaust survivors, so-called Holocaust survivors. And so this was presented on the news every night about these horrible Nazis who were wanting to march and remind these poor survivors of their what had happened to them. And everything that this group of people did was covered on the news. And come to find out, the person that was leading this march is a person by the name of Frank Cohen, but his real name is Frank Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. He mm-hmm. was, in fact, a Jew. And right. his march ended up with like 12 people, but they were making all sorts of threats against the Jews up there. And so this was national news. And then that led to the Holocaust Commission, which was created by Carter in 1979, in which Elie Wiesel was the chairman. And so he used his book, you know, which was principally a novel. And that was the birth of the Holocaust, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which the taxpayers foot the bill for, at least half of the bill, at about $400 million a year. And then you have all the government school teachers teaching this dogma in the public schools. So that was the beginning of the industry and the reparations.
You have to admit, it's been an incredibly successful ploy, hasn't it?
I mean, oh.
How else could it be done? I mean, unbelievable with the public relations that went into making it all happen. Oh, here I found that passage, which I think really deserves. It's out of my video, Holocaust Hate Speech, and Were the Germans So Stupid? And once again, I reiterate, because you know you're going to get, you know, when this is broadcast, you're going to get people calling up and saying hateful anti-Semitism and stuff like this. Every person, anybody that died during that conflict deserves our sympathy. You cannot say they deserve desire. I wouldn't say that at all, because they're Jews or because they were Poles or whatever. But, you know, in the fact is that we have been told certain things which cannot be true. And some of these things are available, and you can look at them, and there they are, but nobody pays any attention. So this is one of the things I wrote, which was in his book From the Depths, published after his death in 1960, Rabbi Michael Dov Ben Weissmandel, a Jewish rescue negotiator, describes how he was told by the Nazis in 1943 that he could have all the Jews in Western Europe and the Balkans for $2 million American dollars. The offer was referred to the Zionists in Switzerland, who turned it down. But with the refusal came another letter written in Hebrew, which included the following: about the cries coming from your country, we should know that all the allied nations are spilling much of their blood. And if we do not sacrifice any blood, by what right shall we merit coming before the bargaining table when they divide nations and lands at the war's end? I put a little footnote on that, sacrificial lambs. Of course, the people in Baal making these decisions were not the ones that were going to be giving their blood. And if anybody cares to, they can look up the video. The title, which is Holocaust Hate Speech and Were the Germans So Stupid, and it's on Vimeo, and it's also back now on YouTube, and go to the notes, and I have a reference of who said that. Lenny Brenner. It's quoted by Lenny Brenner.
Oh, in his 51 documents, or
I can't tell you exactly. Because I went through a lot of material,
sure.
But it's there, and it seems to be very authentic, and one can understand it because, you know, this is what goes on. We have been led to believe a whole load of things, which, I mean, the lampshades and stuff like that is, you know, they've now been totally debunked. But
and yet people still use those myths as if nobody had debunked them.
Well, according to when Rudolf Hess gave his gave evidence, he wasn't tried at Nuremberg. He was tried in Poland. When he gave evidence, he had been tortured. He reckoned that something like, I think, 3,000, total of 3 million people died in Auschwitz, where he was the commander. But they have revised that to just over 1 million now. But still, it's always six. So, you know, the jokey, which I don't find funny, but it's quite often said, was, you know, what is 6 million minus 2 million? The answer is 6 million.
Right.
which it's just, and it just keeps on going. I mean, I have all kinds of discussions about these things, and I'm called anti-Semite and all that kind of thing. I say, well, you know, just tell me, how can it be that it's been admitted by the Polish authorities, who have an Auschwitz museum, of course, at the place, how can they have said and published and have a plaque up which has reduced the number that was first thought of, take away the number you first thought of, and what do you get? The same number. And it's quite incredible. And people will not drop it. And, you know, it's like... One of the videos I made not long ago about who chose the chosen people, and Gideon Levy was saying, you know, he wrote an article in Haaretz saying the Jewish people are people and far from chosen, but he finished his article by saying, but we should keep saying the prayer because it's in our sort of, it's part of our heritage. Well, that is so stupid. You can hardly think that one of the reasons why, if there is anti-Semitism or dislike of people who behave that way, which is nothing but superiority complex, saying, I'm a chosen people, God chose me. He says that they're not chosen, but we should still keep on saying it. It is unbelievable that an intelligent person like Gideon Levy, who writes quite well about on other matters, should want to perpetuate this stupid saying that we are the chosen people and this is the promised land. Those two phrases are so damaging to other people. No matter which way you look at it, they are just so damaging, certainly to the Palestinians, that the promised land is not theirs anymore. The land that they were living in was promised to somebody else, which is absolutely absurd. It's as absurd as, you know, Moses coming off the mountain with a couple of blocks of stone, which he says that God carved some directives into. I mean, it's pathetic these days to actually think that people still cling to these absurd myths and stories. It's fairy tale time, isn't it?
Sure. Well, this whole myth of the 6 million is from their religious dogma, and they really tried to use it after World War One, and it certainly was not effective then. And so they ran it through again after World War Two, in order to secure Israel. You know, Palestine for an Israeli homeland, and it worked.
It's extortion. There's no doubt about it. You know, I just don't know how it's ever going to seep through to the masses.
Well, it's not. Yeah, it's
they've been lied to. You know, they will it.
And why do you suppose that is? You also did a video called AIPAC 101: What Every American Should Know. And I think that would, you know, speaks to why things won't be, why the population will not know these things.
I think it's sports, actually, when you think of it. I mean, American people just love sports, don't they? I mean, they'll talk about the ball game, whichever ball game happens to be in season, and most extraordinary. I think gridiron, I hope you're not a fan, but the stop-start sport. I mean, you never see sort of more than about 8 to 10 seconds of continuous play, and then they all huddle around and talk to each other and everything else. I really do not know how people got brainwashed into thinking that that was interesting to watch.
Yes, it is very interesting, because basically what people are doing when they're watching, they are watching other people work and make millions of dollars and wasting a lot of valuable time. But, you know, I'm not a sports fan at all. But this is so distracting, and it certainly distracts people from life. And then you have other things like reality TV, or which I don't watch either.
I'll stand it. Oh, dear. I really cringe if I sort of channel hop and I see some of these people in The Amazing Race, or what's it, Survivor, here, there, and everywhere, or the cooking programs where the chef shout at people. Oh, it's just becoming so, I don't know, people getting at each other, getting at the people who are putting on the program. They set the competitors against each other, and it's so nastily done.
Yes, it kind of it actually corrupts our culture.
Is it?
I believe it does, and I think, you know, you have to look at who's behind the curtain, so to speak, and who is producing all of this garbage, mm-hmm. who's producing all the trash that comes out of Hollywood, and it's the corporations.
It's a mirror of America, isn't it?
Yes.
This beat your neighbor out the door. There was an old game once, wasn't it? A card game, I think it was. Beat your neighbor out the door. And it really is. There's no sort of help given. You know, it's winner take all. This is the terrible. All of those games. There's not a first, or there's not a second, or a third. It's winner take all, and it really does mirror the American culture, like they call the 1%. I saw a Bloomberg ad the other day, which I thought was a spoof or a joke, and it said, you know, follow this and be one of the 1%. You know, great.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And certainly what we see in our own culture with the sports, as you brought up, they've kind of militarized the country using sports. Because if you think about the music, and if you think about the winners and the losers and the militaristic manner in which they present these sports games, including having the national anthem sung as if this was some sort of a national, well, it is a national pastime for a lot of people, but when you consider the militarization of these events, see why people will go along with the government when the government wants to go into another country and rape and pillage and take all of their resources.
They are like huge political rallies, aren't they? The Super Bowl and things like this. I just saw an item the other day showing the millions of dollars they've just spent on huge TV. If watching the sport live on the field wasn't enough, they now have to have huge TVs so they can see up the whatever of the players that are holding the ball. You know, unbelievable. Did you see that? These TV screens costing millions of dollars each at the end of each of the stadium, this particular stadium. Unbelievable. It is just crazy. It's totally crazy. And yet American education is in the pits. It can probably never recover. The amounts of money that children, aspiring young students have to pay for themselves are horrendous. I mean, at one stage, we were looking for the university to send our son, and we looked at America and we thought, this is absurd. You know, well, nobody can afford that kind of money unless they're ripping somebody else off.
Certainly.
Not possible. How can an ordinary worker do that. You can only go to Wall Street and make billions out of selling, you know, phony stocks or stocks that you know are probably going to fail, like the housing bubble thing. I'm not a very good financial person, so I shouldn't be quoting what I'm quoting. But all of these financial instruments, they call them, like derivatives and things, and not in any way productive. They are just ways of moving money about, and you know, it sticks to the people who are cleverest. That's what it is.
Certainly.
It's not productive at all. I mean, capitalism in a sense, of course, it worked at a certain period where if somebody had a good idea, they needed investment, so they, you know, sold shares and what have you. But, you know, it's gone far past that now. It's just I'm selling all these bits and pieces here and rumors that go around and absurd. I mean, it's can't work.
Right. You've mentioned the movement of money, and that's really what it's all about, whether you're talking about bailouts or whether you're talking about foreclosures where people lose their real estate, which is a real asset to the bankers. And when you're talking about students who have to borrow $100,000 to go to school and then they can't get a job because of the economy, but they still owe that money to the bankers. You know, the people who seem to be benefiting from everything.
The criminals that got it wrong, and they get bailed out, and yet the people who lose their house because they were sold a bill of goods by these terrible salespeople who could be. I read a novel just recently about this. It was very clever, and it was about a woman who had lost her house and everything else. She was then accused of murder, but it was somebody else that did it. But it was a murder mystery. I quite like those things because it takes your mind off the realities of the world. Mind you, there are a lot of real murders, but it was the way that this bank had treated everybody, that somebody targeted the guy who was doing it, and quite rightly, I think. But, I mean, it was just appalling. I've owned a few houses in my time, but I've always been so careful never to go into anything like the kinds of percentage mortgages that most people have. And then, you know, to have some salesman arrive and say, gee, this is a nice place, you put a swimming pool in there. Oh, we can restructure your loan. And everybody says, wow, man, that's terrific. And they probably just come from watching the football match or whatever, and this guy sells it to them. And the next thing you know, there's a bit of a downturn in the market. Up goes their mortgage repayments. One of them loses their job of a family. And that's it. Bang, there's your house gone. And these monsters then, you know, when the real what's it hits the fan for the bankers, they get bailed out. But the poor person that's had their house nicked from under them, basically, they never get bailed out. That's the end of it.
No. Yes. And of course, they don't show this on the national media. They don't show all of the tent cities in America. They don't show the people who are living under the bridges. They don't cover this. You know, they cover the sports events. And if people had, if sports enthusiasts had as much had as much enthusiasm for what is going on in America, what is going on, what is happening to them, you know, maybe things would be turned around. But, you know, if you could get that many people enthused about, you know, like the Holocaust, if you could gather a bunch of people around and say, okay, this is what happened in history, this is why we fought in World War II, and if you told them the truth, how things would be different. But that's not the case. I mean, even in the government schools, you are not going to hear the truth about history. And I think history is an essential thing that we should know, and we should be taught accurate history. And that's what you do.
Well, thank you. Only a few people watch. But Karl Marx said was it Karl Marx or Lenin? Religion is the opiate of the people.
Karl Marx said that.
What was it? Nowadays, it's sport is the opiate of the people, basically. It's just changed. I suppose religion is still there, but the sport has taken over from that tremendously. Although I must say, I do like watching soccer. I much prefer that because the game just keeps on going. It doesn't stop every sort of 2.5 seconds while people sort of bend over and chat to each other and then have a stupid conversation and then throw the ball. And then it goes, stops again for another, after another 10 seconds. But, you know, I am guilty of sitting down and watching the odd soccer match. Manchester United is my team. But I'm not obsessive about it in any way. I enjoy it when it's over. Well, that was good. Bit of entertainment. Everybody needs a bit of entertainment every now and then. There's no doubt about it. Man cannot live by bread alone and all that sort of thing. But,
certainly.
But it's obsessive in the States and other countries with soccer, I suppose. Cricket I don't like very much. I'm sure the Americans don't like cricket, but it's the universities are sort of built around it, aren't they, in the States?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people get recruited to certain universities not because of their academic skills, but because they can play football.
That's right. Well, there was that wonderful old song from, I forget the name, Wonderful Town. There was a song called "I Can Pass the Football." Do you remember that? It came out in the late 50s, early 60s, I think. Late 50s. And it was a great song. It was about this boy who says, "Look at me now, 4 years in college, famous professors tutoring me."
Yeah.
and all because he could pass the football. And that was basically how he got there. He was as dumb as as thick as two short planks, but he could pass the football, so everything was okay, boys.
Unbelievable. And of course, the other pastime is, as we mentioned, watching, reality TV. But also, some of what they refer to as soap operas, or, the weekly soap operas on TV and the comedy shows, which I don't watch any of those things. But people, they live from week to week until they can see that their program again. Yeah. And I think, my word, get a life.
Well, there are some. I watch TV. If when I'm quite old, you probably look up. You can look it up on my channel. But I'm quite old, and after I've been at the computer for a few hours, I just get tired, so I go and flop in front of the TV and I channel surf and I find somewhere. Like, there are one or two humorous programs and quite interesting courtroom drama stuff, but not many these days. I'm getting a bit tired of them, I must say, but I don't find that a terrible thing. I don't find myself thinking of myself as a couch potato, but I'm quite selective at what I watch, and I will not. I refuse to watch people beating each other out and in terrible programs like Wipeout or, those other stupid programs. But then, I'm not an average person, but I do enjoy a good story. But what happened to good movies? It's all, you remember the days of the good movies? What was the last good movie you had with a good plot, a good story? Something like Dial M for Murder or something, the original.
Oh, yes, that was a good movie. I like the older movies.
Yeah,
yes.
No, the ones that had a plot, that had a story. And they
and
didn't
no
have
sex and violence.
That's right. Well, these days it's all, superheroes and huge machines build themselves, and I just find them so tedious. Okay, we can do this with super duper computer graphics. So this is how we're going to bore everybody to death, and people go and watch them. I mean, there's no human interest in them. It's just quite weird. If I watch a movie, I want to be interested in one of the people or two of the people. I want to feel for them. I want a bit of emotion from them, but not machines that sort of put themselves together.
Sure. But that's movies are part of our culture, and television programs are part of our culture. And I think they kind of drive the culture. They give people their perceptions. And those perceptions are certainly invalid in many cases. So,
well, yeah, this is true. Steven Spielberg has a lot to answer for that.
Yes.
Because when you think of that film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, it was nothing but hype. That film was hype from beginning to end. Nothing happened in that film, actually, if you look at that film and analyze it. But from the moment it was thought about and, in development, they were talking about it and everything else, and the way it was built up, it was cleverly done. There's no doubt about it. But if you ask somebody who saw that film a few years, what it was about, well, aliens arrived, didn't they? And they played a tune, and somebody thought, well, my dog has fleas like tuning a banjo. Da 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 da. Wow, they have music. The aliens have music. Gee. And it was full of shots of people sort of walking toward this light and looking up. It's just the most awful film. But Star Wars was far better because it had stories and plots and it had people who you cared about and stuff like that. But Spielberg's movies,
Well, he's done, like Schindler's List. I mean, that was certainly a propaganda piece. And think that a lot of the things that he has done have been propaganda pieces. And his Shoah Foundation, which he is, videoing all of these so-called Holocaust survivors who tell these ridiculous stories that are unbelievable if you actually listen to them.
Oh, yeah, I have. There's also a lot of them who say, yeah, they were in the orchestra at Auschwitz and they were swimming in the pool, but you never get to hear about those things, do you?
No. They just bring out the
ridiculous. Well, Schindler's List, actually, was written by an Australian, I'm ashamed to say. I mean, the book, the original book, wasn't Schindler's List, was it? It was called Schindler's Ark, actually, originally. Schindler's Ark. Thomas Keneally wrote it. He's also written a few other good books, but I mean, he fell apart with that one, I think. I think he was sucked into the whole ethos of the suffering Jews in Germany. And of course they suffered. And of course there must have been. I was married to a Norwegian whose grandfather the stunning story. His grandfather was going to be indicted after the war for collaborating. He was the sort of equivalent of the mayor of a small township outside of Oslo, and he was indicted. He had a good house, nice looking house, and the Germans billeted themselves there, the officers. And after the war, he was charged with collaboration. And somebody, I mean, the most extraordinary circumstance, my ex-wife was going to write a book about it, but she decided to drink more than she would write and never got around to it, which is a shame because it was a stunning story. Well, I've seen the house, I've visited the house, and it had a huge basement. A lot of it was just earth and stuff. And anyway, so this guy was about to be indicted for conspiring because when the Germans were staying there, they got on with him quite well. What else could you do? Apparently there was a guy, nice German lieutenant, to play the piano rather well, and they had a piano and this sort of thing. And when somebody, a news item, turned up in some weird, out-of-the-way place in Canada somewhere, and it was read by one of the Jews that he had helped to escape to Sweden. Quite extraordinary story. And this guy got in touch with the prosecutors, and they brought him over, and he stood at his trial and said, no, he was being friendly with the Germans so that he could be a halfway house for Jews trying to get to Sweden. Isn't that a remarkable story?
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, now you have a YouTube channel, and we need to let the listeners know how they can get to your YouTube channel.
All right. I always have to look it up, but I can do that right now. Yeah.
It's youtube.com/user/ALawson911. Is that it?
911. That's right. Well, you've got it. You do it better than me. That's it. It's quite easy. And have a look at a few of the films in there. And if you care for them, pass them on to others. That's the main thing. Or you can make a comment on them and abuse me if you want. If I get something. Well, I get a lot of that.
Well, your last film, International Bureau of Double Standards, has a lot of comments. I mean, if you know, it's pages and pages and pages of comments, and it just came out, and I'm very impressed with the comments, and I would say that they're all positive.
Yeah, they are. I got one from some guy who said, "I agree with everything you say, blah, 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 but I think you're anti-Semitic."
Yeah.
I didn't allow the car. I get fed up with that. So I wrote to him. I responded back there, and I said, "Tell me, give me one instant." I explained to him that he was wrong to use the term anti-Semitic, because it applies to a group of languages, which most people know these days. And I said, "You know, give me one instance where I have been anti anything in that." I admit to being anti-Zionist. I can't stand the Zionist doctrine. I can't stand Zionist Israel and the way it's punishing the Palestinians for just being Palestinians and this sort of thing. But no, I'm not anti-Semitic. I don't like many religions or any religions, frankly. I don't even go much on Buddhism. It's all right, but if you look really back at Buddha, he left his wife and his family to go and find the meaning of life, which wasn't very kind.
No. Maybe that was the meaning of life, you know, your wife and your family.
That's right. And Jesus said some really nice things and was very sensible, and do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and turn the other cheek and stuff like that. That's lovely. But the problem is that all of these things then become, you know, tools in somebody else's hands to control other people.
Sure.
And when you see the bowing of heads and bottoms and things in Islam and the weird, wonderful, you know, groupings, meetings, you know, bowing down to the guy standing on a balcony with a huge hat and a golden robe and things, the Pope. I mean, it's just gone too far. It's not what it should be.
Sure.
People starving in favelas, for example, in Brazil. The doctrine of no contraception in places like the Philippines, which they're fighting against now, where we all know that if the world keeps on going the way it is, as far as population growth goes, it's going to mean a whole load of people are going to die very early because there's not enough food for them.
I think that it's the control of food that's the problem, not necessarily...
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, it's the distribution.
Yeah.
There's going to be enough. But, I mean, there has to come a time when, you know, people have to have a choice whether they want a whole load of children or they don't.
Sure, that's personal choice.
A bunch of people who don't like to do it anyway.
But I'm sure, you know, like in Afghanistan, I'm sure that the people should be growing food that they can actually eat instead of poppies that the ruling elite can make money off of. I mean, the same thing happened in China with heroin. I mean, millions of people died of starvation because certain people in China decided that they would go ahead and grow the, you know, the poppies or whatever to produce heroin. So,
The Brits that was buying it from them and selling it to India and getting the tea, wasn't it?
Terrible situation. There are reasons behind, you know, and the same thing basically happened in the Philippines early on, where they were growing everything that they needed to be independent in the Philippines, and then the United States invades in 1898, and pretty soon they're just growing certain things and depending on the United States for imports. So.
I made some commercials in the Philippines. I'm such lovely people. I had some wonderful times there, but the corruption there
is
awful. But the famous story that I keep repeating, my son says, yes, I've heard that, Dad. But there was one, it was about 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was, that I think it was in Ghana. There was a supermarket selling frozen chickens, which had been imported from the United States. And they were cheaper than the real live ones could be grown on the little sort of vacant lot beside this supermarket complex where people were just sort of feeding them little odds and ends and things like this. And by the time they'd taken up their time and, you know, killed them and dressed them and everything else, they had to sell them for more than the frozen chickens cost in the supermarket that had come from the United States of America. Isn't that unbelievably absurd?
Yes. Well, same thing that's happened in this country. You know, imports from China are cheaper than what they could be made for here in this country. And you have to look at the unions, you have to look at other factors in all of this. But it's very interesting. Well, Ed, talk about interesting. Our conversation has been very interesting. And I certainly do appreciate you joining me. We'll have to do this again.
Well, thank you, Deanna. It's been really, really pleasant chatting with you. And yes, I'd like to do it again. Maybe not sort of tomorrow, because I'd not be able to think of anything to say. But
I doubt that.
Well, I could tell a few jokes.
Well, bless your heart.
I thought of starting one of my videos with another one I heard the other day, but I can't remember what it was. But never mind. I did start one of my videos. I don't know if you remember the WikiLeaks video with a joke. Did I tell you that one?
No. Tell it.
Did you see that? Okay, I'll tell it as a final sign-off. Okay, this guy's a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist is starting to show him pictures, you know, nice scenery and flowers and things. And every time he shows him a picture, the subject says, the psychiatrist says, what does this bring to your mind? He says, sex. And then he shows him another one, which is of a, you know, street scene, sex. Picture of a flower, sex. And he goes on, everything, sex. And the psychiatrist says, well, I think I might have discovered the problem. You seem to be obsessed with sex. And he says, I'm obsessed? You're the one that's with all the pornographic pictures.
I heard that coming.
Which I think that's the reason why that got quite a few views, that one. Because I actually concluded sex in the title, you see. That if I made a video the next time, I'm going to try putting Kitty Cat Up a Tree being saved by firemen in Iran. Maybe.
Well, Anthony, it's been delightful.
Thank you, Deanna. It's been nice.
Alrighty.
Where's Spingola? Is it, what name is it?
That's an Italian name. I'm not Italian, but yes, that's my married name.
Language. I like the Italian language. Deanna Spingola.
Yes, it's Italian. Is very romantic.
Oh, it's wonderful. Wonderful language. I mean, the operas, you know, the stories are so silly, but the music is just
beautiful.
Verdi.
Yes.
Okay. All right, Deanna.
Thank you. Take care. Okay, take care too. Bye-bye.
Bye.